What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Good morning, Mark.
G'day, Brent. Well, at least my intro jingle worked. That sounded good.
Good on you. Well done. Mate, can I ask you how warm is it where you are?
Well, it's been incredibly humid. I live in the southwest of Sydney out near Camden, and I was out walking the dogs on Friday evening, and, you know, I've lived, over 60 years in Western Sydney. It was the most humid conditions I've ever encountered, and the storm that night was totally tropical. I thought it might have woke me in the middle of the night, and the roof was shaking. I thought it was an earthquake. It was right. The extent of the storm. So the humidity has been off the radar. I've never felt anything like it.
We, on a Saturday morning, we go all over the place on the Super Radio Network. I'm just looking for the weather details that I had here. Can I find it? Yeah, no, I've got so many pieces of paper here. Here's the weather details. So we go all over the place in New South Wales and into southern Queensland. These are some of the temperatures that were around about 9 o'clock. So Bathurst, it was a normal 23 degrees. But let's go coastal areas like Coffs Harbour. At 9 o'clock, it was 31 degrees. Lismore, 31. Port Macquarie, 29. We go up to the Gold Coast, 30 degrees up there. Newcastle, 30 degrees. Parkes, 23 inland. And so strange temperatures, 26 in Sydney. So, and that was a bit after 9 o'clock this morning. So it is hot, 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 mate.
Well, we're in summer, but the humidity adds, 7 or 8 degrees in how it feels as you walk around. And it's been unbearable, I've got to say.
All right, let's talk about the new GDP figures. This week showed Australia's economy grew by just 0.3% in the September quarter, with annual growth dropping to 0.8%. Now, that's the worst performance since the 1990-91 recession. The Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, he's blamed the government and their high spending and immigration policies for fueling inflation and causing a decline in living standards, with GDP per person going backwards. Mark, would Australia have already slipped into a recession without the government's spending lifeline, or are we just really delaying the inevitable?
Well, the spending, big spending and deficit by Jim Chalmers, its main impact really is to drive up inflation, which holds interest rates higher than they would otherwise be. So Chalmers says, our spending has stopped the economy from going into recession. But if he didn't have the big spending, we would have had interest rate relief by now, and that would have helped the economy grow, probably more than these feeble figures in the September quarter. So the big spending is never really a solution because it offsets what the Reserve Bank would be doing, and Australia is now one of the few advanced economies where interest rates aren't coming down, and that's due to Jim Chalmers and the extent of the budget deficit that he's driving us into. But the other big factor, of course, Brent, is immigration. If you take immigration out, we're definitely in recession, and we've had 7 consecutive quarters of what they call a per capita recession, and the decline in living standards over the last 3 years, so basically the Albanese government, has been over 10%. Now, these are train wreck figures for a government going into an election in the first half of next year. When we talk about the cost of living crisis, that's the real bell-ringing figure. Over 10% drop in living standards over the last 3 years. Productivity, you know, if we had productivity, the economy grows and everyone's better off, you can get real wage increases. Productivity under this government now has got us back to 2016 levels. We're back 8 years behind where we were, you know, back 8 years in history. So the economic management by the Albanese government, there's nothing there, absolutely nothing there, to say any positive news or any reason people would re-elect them on economic management.
It's a bit of a mess, isn't it? Is it any wonder then, with all of that, that most of the polls that are coming out at the moment have the coalition, Peter Dutton, in front? In fact, I was reading a story, I think it was yesterday, that in the world of betting, Peter Dutton's odds on to win the election come, you know, probably May next year at this point in time.
Well, if people vote on the economy, those odds are correct. And there's no way out for Albanese and Chalmers. There's no miracle solution to these train wreck figures. Economic growth sluggish, 7 quarters per capita recession, 10% worse off over the last 3 years in living standards, interest rates too high. They're four realities that Australians face on a daily basis, and there's no escape from the way Labor's mismanaged the economy. So, yeah, the orthodoxy always is that a first-term government will get a second chance from the Australian people, but the betting markets have probably got it right at this time. Dutton is really in with a chance of upending that orthodoxy and tossing this mob out after just 3 years.
Where we sit today, Mark, I mean, they've got a couple of months off, so people having Christmas and the summer celebrations and holidays will forget about politics for a while, and then we come back, I suppose, and get stuck into it in February. What do you think Labor have to do, from where they are now, what do you think that Labor have to do to claw back enough support to win the election in May?
Well, it's true, people go on holiday and they forget about politics, but nobody can forget about economics and the real-life impact of this cost-of-living crisis. So Labor needs to find a way of massively cutting waste and mismanagement in the budget and handing that money over to some targeted, effective cost-of-living relief, but also getting the budget back into surplus very quickly so we can get interest rate relief. The Reserve Bank can start to act on monetary policy. So they're big things that Jim Chalmers should have done sometime over the last 2.5 years, and he's failed dismally on that front. Will they scramble and have a mini-budget? Well, they've got a budget, possibly, before the next election. It needs to be a budget that achieves things massively that Chalmers and Albanese have ignored for 2.5 years. So, Brent, it's very, very unlikely. I don't see Labor getting out of this economic mess that they've created. And for their electorate chances, I'm sure their advisers and their internal pollsters are pulling their hair out.
The other problem I think that Labor are going to face is, will the general public believe what Labor promised? Because there has been so much talk about the broken promises that that Labor went to the last election in. I think that anything that's promised by the Labor Party this time around, people just simply won't believe them. It's got to the boy cry wolf situation.
Yeah, absolutely. The public discount down these promises. Albanese said a $275 reduction in electricity bills. Today that just looks laughable. But I think the message for Peter Dutton is don't go making big, expensive promises. Just stick to fixing the economic fundamentals, the budget back into long-term surplus, paying down debt, bringing down interest rates, stabilising inflation, and productivity measures. The biggest thing that Angus Taylor, as the Shadow Treasurer, can do is a productivity plan for Australia. We haven't had one really since the time of the Howard government and before them Keating and Hawke. So I think they're the big things that would be sensible in the election campaign, and probably good policy would end up being good politics.
I know there's been stories and rumblings this week about Jim Chalmers and the chance of him becoming Prime Minister. The story I read was that, there's a chance there that he'll become Prime Minister before the election. I can't see that happening. But can you see him as a genuine, leader of the opposition if they were to lose the election in May?
Well, not on his economic record. He's been a terrible failure as Treasurer. He was schooled by Wayne Swan back in the day, and that obviously shines through. If Labor loses this election on the economy, why would they make the author of that loss their leader in opposition? There'd be other people putting their hands up, but I think it's true Albanese will hold the Prime Ministership until Election Day. He's paid a lot of attention to the caucus, like Kevin Rudd, arrogant, treating the caucus like dirt. Albanese is pretty experienced and factional in that regard, and I don't think there's any chance of him losing the job, even if Labor looks like losing the election.
Now, speaking of the Prime Minister, he continues to face growing criticism for not labelling the Melbourne synagogue firebombing as terrorism. Jewish leaders, former officials and critics like Josh Frydenberg, for example, have accused him of being too slow and unclear in addressing anti-Semitism. Calls for a national police task force and inquiries into campus anti-Semitism have intensified. This story is obviously not going away, Mark, and it seems as though the Prime Minister, he's gone into hiding.
Well, I'm a critic of Albanese, as you've just heard, on the economy, but I think in fairness, Don't they need to catch the culprits and find out their motive before labelling the firebombing anything in particular? It may have been terrorism, but it may have been a dozen other possible reasons. Internal disputes, disenchantment, random idiots, who knows the causes of this. So there's been an avalanche of media coverage saying it's anti-Semitism and terrorism. I just always think when a major crime has been committed, it's prudent for everyone to wait until the culprits have been caught and the police can interview them and identify a motive. So I think wait for that. But the reaction has been over the top. Albanese is directly responsible for a lot of bad things that have happened in Australia, particularly on the economic front. But I don't think you can say he's directly responsible for this, which seems to be a lot of the narrative.
I suppose what people are saying is that, look, for example, the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, he came out on Friday and said, you know, it was a terrorist attack. A lot of people are agreeing with him. And a lot of people are saying that Chris Minns, he was on the front foot in reference to handling this, and that the Prime Minister should have taken a page out of Chris Minns' book and done exactly the same thing. I mean, today there's a story that he's proposed legislation to ban protests outside places of worship following what's gone on with targeting synagogues and mosques. The measure's intended to protect religious communities from harassment and ensure safety during worship.
Well, I don't think there's any direct link between people protesting anywhere and the firebombing that you've got that synagogue in Melbourne. My general view is that Australia would be much better off if the troubles and hatreds and violence of the Middle East weren't imported into our country with the Palestinian movement and all the hysteria about that. We'd be much better off if we just recognised it's a problem in the Middle East and didn't make it Australia's problem. So you can get an overreaction here. I think the best thing to do, anyone who breaks the law, bringing Middle Eastern problems to Australia, we should deport them, and if they can't be deported, put them on Christmas Island in detention. So send a very firm message. We don't want the troubles of the Middle East coming to Australia. Beyond that, how does Chris Minns know what happened? If Chris Minns knows who did the firebombing and why in Melbourne, he's a premier from another state, he should hand that information over to the Victorian police. Obviously he hasn't. It's ridiculous. He's just making that up as his own sort of publicity coverage to endear himself to a certain part of the community. But people in law and order have got to act on evidence. Minns doesn't know the exact cause of this, nor does anyone else. So why overreact in that regard? The general message over the past year and a bit after October 7 last year should have been, if you feel strongly enough about these hatreds and wars in the Middle East, go there and fight them instead of bringing these troubles to the streets and other parts of Australian public life. That should have been the message from our political leaders instead of the sort of nonsense and overreaction we hear now.
Speaking of the Premier, Mr. Minns, he's faced calls for a referral to the ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption, regarding the controversial handling of the Rose Hill Racecourse redevelopment proposal. Allegations of a lack of transparency and potential conflicts of interest have surfaced in parliamentary inquiries, raising concerns about the project's integrity. Obviously, there were headline stories that you featured in about this last week, Mark.
Yeah, well, we might recall the Berejiklian ruling at ICAC that said that a premier can't further or even maintain a close personal relationship in public duties. And that's a very clear standard of behaviour. Basically, it means if you've got a really good friend, you can't involve them in your decision-making and the exercise of your public duties. Berejiklian got in trouble and lost her job over Darryl Maguire and that relationship. Chris Minns has had a close personal relationship with a guy called Steve McMahon, who came to him on the 30th of October last year in what Minns tried to keep as a secret meeting for a plan to sell Rose Hill Racecourse, very amateurish plan, no detailed information. And one of the things Minns did, he didn't involve senior public servants in that meeting on the 30th of October, which would have cleared up a lot of the misinformation. But he also sidelined and froze what they call the Camellia Rose Hill Place strategy, which was for 10,000 new dwellings, something that the Department of Planning had worked on since 2015, and he didn't even tell his planning secretary he'd done this. She found out by accident on the 6th of December at a social event that the government effectively had frozen her plan and favoured the plan of Minns's mate Steve McMahon to sell all of Rose Hill. Now, I just think that's appalling governance. It certainly, I think, is worse than what happened with Berejiklian, and I think it well and truly warrants an ICAC investigation into this.
When will that decision be made?
Well, it's up to ICAC. What we do know is that someone broke the news of this committee resolution to the media that the big item in the Rose Hill committee report was referring Chris Minns to ICAC. Well, I can tell you, Brent, that person wasn't me. What we do know is that the Labor members handed this material around inside the government, and that's possibly where it came from and gained that media prominence. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. I can tell you that examining and reading the Berejiklian judgment, as I have, would mean that Minns has got a big problem with regard to ICAC. Now, people can say, oh, Gladys was badly treated and ICAC went overboard. But ICAC's got to be consistent. You can't rub out one premier and then say a second premier who's done pretty well exactly the same thing has nothing to answer for.
Yeah, true. I mean, when you think of some of the premiers that have been rubbed out, to use your words, in the past for next to nothing. I mean, if we remember the bottle of wine in reference to Barry,
Barry O'Farrell,
a bottle of wine.
Nick Greiner back in the day, something more serious. So three Liberal premiers have run foul of ICAC. ICAC set a standard there. Effectively, it was a new standard in the Berejiklian ruling. But once they set that standard, they've got to be consistent. And Chris Minns was poorly advised to ever meet with his long-standing Labor mate Steve McMahon on the 30th of October, let alone to get his proposal up and running inside the government. He should have brought in the planning secretary, the head of Metro, and said, listen, Steve, you people at the ATC have got any ideas for a residential rezoning, you take it up with the officials. More than that, Minns should have declared a conflict of interest and said, I'll meet with the head, the chair and the CEO of the Australian Turf Club, instead of his good friend Steve McMahon.
Okay, tensions between the Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese, and the Environment Minister, Tania Plibersek. Well, they have emerged over policy decisions and their implications for environmental protection. A key point of contention is the government's stance on Tasmanian salmon farming, with Tania Plibersek emphasising the environmental risks, while the Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese, prioritises industry engagement and economic interests. This is coming to the boil, this I suppose, heat between the two and their relationship?
Yeah, it's a weird thing, isn't it? Plibersek and Albanese have known each other very well, in fact, over decades, adjoining seats in the middle of Sydney, same left-wing Labor faction. But now Plibersek seems to be operating like a separate satellite of the Albanese government, with her agenda to protect a stingray-type fish in the Macquarie Harbour on the west coast of Tasmania at the expense of all the salmon fishing. And salmon jobs, a really big industry in that part of the Tasmanian state. Albanese says he wants to do something about it. It's like he's saying, I'm only the Prime Minister. I can't protect the jobs and overrule the Environment Minister. So it's a weird setup, isn't it?
Well, I suppose we've seen an example of that where, you know, the gold mine. I mean, the Prime Minister came out and said it should go ahead, but he didn't. Tania Plibersek, no, but he didn't turn around and stand up, if you like, to Tania Plibersek. Overrule, that would probably be the right word to use. He didn't overrule Tania Plibersek's decision.
Well, that's why I say she looks like she's operating as a separate orbiting planet or satellite of the Albanese government, with her own decision-making powers that don't necessarily fall under the coverage of Cabinet. The easiest thing for Albanese, with both gold mine and the salmon fishing jobs in Tasmania, is bring it to a Cabinet decision. Say to Tania Plibersek, you fluffed around for long enough with your environmental studies and delays, bring the material to Cabinet and we'll have a Cabinet decision about it, which then becomes a decision of the government. So if he hasn't got the power to directly overrule her or get her on the phone and say, listen, you've got to put jobs ahead of stingray fish, then bring it to the Cabinet and get a decision and give the industry certainty, whether it's the gold miners in Western New South Wales or it's the salmon fishers in Tasmania. That would be the best governing thing for Albanese, a bit of leadership on that front.
The New South Wales Drug Summit, it brought together experts, policymakers, community leaders to discuss comprehensive strategies for addressing drug use, addiction and related social issues. The summit aimed to explore reforms like pill testing, cannabis laws, decriminalisation, while focusing on public health and safety concerns. Mark, do you think the drug summit ended up achieving its goals?
Well, it was a travelling circus. They went through four different days in different parts of New South Wales and came up with nothing. Why have these summits sort of like a political cop-out? Oh, we'll have a summit instead of a drug policy. That's what Min said at the last election, and then come up with nothing. The main problem with the pill testing is that it's inexact. If the testing is wrong, and the government, by virtue of this policy and the testers, say that a young person is safe to have these pills and it backfires and there's a major health problem, even a fatality, who deals with not only the human tragedy of that, the economic liability involved? If pill testing was 100% perfect, well, maybe you could go ahead with it. So that's the main problem there that I don't think they'll overcome. The other argument is about cannabis legalisation in New South Wales, and while I'm sort of not completely on one side or the other of that debate, I do support the idea of my upper house colleague John Ruddock have a plebiscite about it at the next election in March 2027, so the New South Wales public can decide, because quite frankly on that issue there's gridlock in the parliament. There's MPs, government ministers like Rose Jackson, who would support legalisation of cannabis in New South Wales, but because she's in the cabinet she can't really express her true opinion and vote that way. So I hand it over to the New South Wales people to make their judgment at a plebiscite, as we've had plebiscites in the past, like daylight saving, and let the people decide.
Yeah, good thought. New South Wales, in New South Wales, around 12,000 of 76,000 students undertaking the HSC have applied for disability provisions this year, reflecting a steady increase in such applications over recent years. These provisions, which include adjustments like extra time, rest breaks and modified papers, aim to ensure equitable access to exams for students with diverse needs as required under federal anti-discrimination laws. And a lot of these 12,000, I believe, Mark, are from private schools too.
Well, and public, it's a mixture, but yeah, probably private schools are overrepresented, but Brent, at the end of the day, one in six HSC students are pleading disability, and to get these concessions, more time to complete the exam or a reader, a support person with them, a second person to do the exam, you've got to say, I know there'd be some who are completely genuine, I wouldn't suggest otherwise, but you've got to say one in six, there's got to be some rorts going on here, where the system is way out of control. There can't be one in six students who can successfully plead disability. And perhaps, you know, the NDIS is an example of this. The whole disability thing has got a bit out of control. The New South Wales Parliament during the week put out some figures to say there's 20% of Australians who've got a disability and 85% have got what they call a hidden disability, one that you can't immediately see. Well, maybe the disability is mathematics, because that's 105% of the population got a disability, 20 plus 85. So, one of the problems of government and big spending is that there are groups who invent problems, invent victims, and then invent advocacy and research groups that soak up government money for their own personal benefit. And that's a huge problem across the board. And I think in disability, we need some hard-headed analysis of who's really got a disability, give them the money and support, because at the moment, it's being spread so widely that the truly disabled are being ripped off.
All right, mate, I'll let you go. Thank you, as always, for spending some time with us each and every Sunday morning. When do you go for a break?
Oh, not really. Probably in January.
Okay.
So up till about the 7th of January, Brent, I'm working away, not at the desk necessarily, but certainly in my home office and staying across all the research and different jobs that I do. So up till then, happy to talk and always look forward to it on a Sunday.
Likewise, we will then catch up with you next Sunday, same time, same channel.
Yeah,
thanks,
well, you're
Mark.
A hard worker too. You're going right through, aren't you?
I am, mate. Yeah, going all the
How
way through.
How lucky are your listeners? Good on you, Brent.
Thanks, Mark. Talk to you next Sunday, mate.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye. That is Mark Latham.